Hi, everybody. We need your help if you like this podcast. Make sure you subscribe if you're not already getting us every day. And tell your friends. Plus, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us in a big way, and it helps other people find us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Thanks for joining us today. We begin on day 26 of the government shutdown with a figure that might surprise you: how much the shutdown could cost the U.S. economy. According to some estimates, the economy could lose roughly $6 billion if the shutdown continues for another 2 weeks. In other words, the cost could be more than the $5.7 billion President Donald Trump is demanding for his border wall. And when Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell spoke to the Economic Club of Washington, D.C. last week, he pointed out just how unprecedented this situation is.
In the short term, if government shutdowns don't last very long, they have typically not left much of a mark on the economy, which isn't to say that there's plenty of personal hardship that people undergo. But at the aggregate level, the economy generally does not reflect much damage from a shutdown. A longer shutdown is something we haven't had. If we have an extended shutdown, I do think that would show up in the data pretty clearly.
So just how much is the shutdown costing the U.S. taxpayer? And when this whole thing is over and federal employees finally receive their back pay, what will the long-term economic damage be? Here to help us out is CNBC senior economics reporter Steve Leisman. Steve, it's nice to have you on the show.
Good to be here.
So we threw out some pretty big numbers at the top, a $6 billion estimate on what this could cost us. Where are these estimates coming from, and what exactly do they represent?
Well, you have a private sector economist, and now the White House, in a story that we broke yesterday, actually doubling their estimate of the cost of the shutdown. What they do is they look at the wages that are earned by the federal workers. They look at the wages that are earned by the private contractors. They look at the amount of input to the economy by the government. And they come up with about a 0.1% subtraction every week. And for the White House, that's double their prior estimate. They were at 0.1% every 2 weeks, but they took a little finer pencil to the accounting there, and they doubled their cost estimate here. And they think about the broader economic activity that their wages spurn. Now, you have to say that after some point in time, the economy will get back some of it, because at least the federal workers will get their wages back, but not necessarily the private contractors. And you're starting to read some pretty dire stories about some of these small firms and medium-sized businesses that do business with the government that basically can't get by and pay their workers and their health insurance and those sorts of things if they don't get checks from the government for their work, even the back checks for works they did in November for a month or so.
And Steve, I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about the costs of government shutdowns tends to end up costing more money than keeping the government open. Why is that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, a couple things. First of all, governments bring in revenue, and part of the issues are the extent to which the government can bring in revenue. And I assume also that there's some feedback from the people who get their work and pay their taxes back to the government. There's just different ways that the government actually adds to economic activity and its ability to gather revenue.
Now, we hear a lot of talk about this. Economists often say it's costing us, and that's us in quotes, money.
Right.
Who is it really costing? What is it that everyday Americans are feeling, or how are they feeling this loss, if at all?
Well, I think the way I think about impacts like this, and we maybe come back to this, but it's a similar to an impact of a hurricane, is you draw sort of widening concentric circles. Start with the individual and the workers not getting their paycheck. Broaden it out to the community, especially communities that rely heavily on either federal dollars or rely on a lot of federal employment. And then broaden it out of that. You know, I did some work on this, and there are 879,000 workers in the metropolitan statistical area of Milwaukee. So there are 800,000 furloughed federal workers. So it's as if the entire metropolitan statistical area of Milwaukee was not getting a paycheck for a month. And just getting back to the hurricane idea, you have these situations where it happens and there's a deep hit to it, and then you have a kind of rebound from the additional spending. You don't have that. So we all sort of feel it. And it's also probably worth talking about, you know, the federal government provides services that people use. There are parks and there are all sorts of things that the federal government does that we pay our taxes for and we get it. We're not getting those services now. in some ways, obviously, because it's a partial shutdown.
Right. But I mean, and there are also a lot of banks and businesses that have been supportive or pretty supportive of the president so far. Are you hearing anything from the financial sector in terms of how they seem to be viewing the shutdown?
I don't hear a backlash at this moment against President Trump, if that's what you're asking. I do think that there's a lot of exasperation. I think it's worth maybe pointing out that this president was supposed to be a boon to business in terms of providing stability and support for businesses. And in some way, he has been, I guess, the corporate tax cuts and some of the deregulation. But there are vast areas where the president of this administration has added to uncertainty. And I think you can lop in this extended government shutdown in with the trade tensions in there and the otherwise, what do you want to call it, volatile foreign policy and other ways that this administration makes policies in a way that is not friendly to business. You can have an example of companies that have to kind of line up for exemptions from their tariffs. So lop it all together, and what you have is you have declining confidence among CEOs. And the concern is, you know, you go back to the tax cuts, and the president's express desire there was to boost capital spending. Well, one of the things that's a huge inhibitor to capital spending is uncertainty. So we hear stories of businesses that are holding back on capital spending because of the uncertainty from a variety of policies, and I think the government shutdown is one of them.
Well, we also heard Delta's CEO this week saying that the government shutdown was affecting what they were trying to do in terms of new products and getting new things to bring in new things to market. Jamie Dimon, who is one of the president's economic advisors, actually said yesterday on a conference call for Q4 that he wants this shutdown to come to a conclusion. So it does seem to be that there are folks wanting this to end, even on the business side. I'm wondering, you know, we all talk about having a credit rating, Steve. We don't have to talk about our personal credit scores here, but the United States kind of has a credit rating. And is this going to affect it?
Not the shutdown itself. The question is what happens with the debt ceiling. That is something that tends to impact the rating agency's views of America. And if this shutdown tells us that, I believe it's later this year that the debt ceiling, in other words, our ability to borrow, to raise the amount of debt that we borrow, if that becomes obstructed and this shutdown and the impasse in Congress tells us that we might be headed for a more serious financial problem, which is a debate over the debt ceiling, then yes, the credit rating would be affected in that regard,
And we also saw that there was a credit rating agency that said that, named Fitch, that said that this could actually jeopardize our AAA rating here. So something to think about. What about the SEC? What's happening with them? How is this impacting or the shutdown being impacted by what's happening at the SEC?
I'm going to tell you, Tanzina, I'm not 100% sure. I know that they are affected by this, that a lot of their workers have been furloughed. I have been dealing with several government agencies. Some officials have called me themselves to discuss things when normally their workers would call me or call me back, for example, their public relations people. But now the principal calls me, which is obviously good for me as a reporter. I talked to one official who asked me not to use their name because they are forbidden being on furlough from doing government business. I don't know the extent to which the SEC has had limited enforcement as a result of their of workers being furloughed there.
The last we've been shutting down the government, not just isn't something new. We've seen this happen for decades. And the last major shutdown was in 2013 when the White House's Office of Management and Budget estimated at that time, 2013, that the country had lost $2 billion, that's billion with a B, in productivity because of the fact that federal workers were sent home. The credit rating agency Standard & Poor's put the overall cost to the country at $24 billion. Again, we're talking about 2013, government shutdown. Were there long-term economic effects, Steve, after that shutdown?
I don't think so. And I think we do have issues now because the longer this lasts, we are in a pretty tight labor market right now. And one of the longer-lasting economic impacts you can imagine is that workers say, the heck with this. I'm not working for a company that every now and then is going to make me work for a month without or longer without a paycheck. And so you can imagine that some of these workers have better employment opportunities. And so at the end of this, they may have trouble finding people. I know they were having trouble finding people to begin with, so they may have more difficulty that way. again, I think the overall disruption to business, the volatility to business is something that creates uncertainty. Wall Street doesn't mind very much when there's gridlock. They sometimes say this is a good thing, that the government won't be passing any new laws. I think they mind when there's a shutdown. Look, government is 20% of the economy. And obviously, it's only a partial shutdown, but you don't lose a chunk of the economy without businesses across the spectrum. And frankly, American citizens across the spectrum feeling some impact of that. And that's, you know, we're kind of waiting to see what happens with TSA employees and that sort of thing, where you get major disruptions to air travel, major disruptions to commerce and transportation, that's when the hue and cry might finally reach those people with the power to end the shutdown.
What happens, Steve, if this continues, as it appears to continue with no end in sight at this point?
Well, there are increasingly dire forecasts here. It began with the White House upping its estimate of the shutdown, but there are other private sector economists who think that growth in the United States could go negative, or essentially the economy could shrink in the first quarter as a result of this. For reasons that are probably not worth explaining on air here, but the first quarter is statistically weaker than the other three. It's a problem in the data. Everybody knows about it in the business. And so you're starting off from probably a weaker base. You take that off, you add the trade tensions to it. What happened is there were these things that were not big by themselves. For example, economists estimated that the problems with trade and tariffs might take off 0.1 or 0.2. And then they thought, oh, well, another 0.1 or 0.2. And then you lop that into the idea that the first quarter starts off from a weaker base. And at least Ian Shepherdson from Pantheon Macroeconomics, he thinks it's possible to have a negative first quarter. And a negative first quarter on top of for Wall Street, obviously you've been following what's been happening. We had 1,000-point swings and a pretty substantial drop in stock prices. And that was before the shutdown, right? So you had concerns about global economic weakness. You had concerns about the Federal Reserve raising interest rates, the trade tensions that I keep mentioning. And then you lop on the shutdown. You keep adding up 0.1, 0.2, 0.2. And all of a sudden, if you're starting on a 2% base, well, you've whittled away a good chunk of that growth that we were otherwise going to have.
Steve Leisman is a senior economics reporter at CNBC. Steve, thanks so much. It was great having you on.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And on day 26 of the government shutdown, we're still hearing from you.
Hey, this is Chris from Denver, Colorado. I am a federal government employee, but I think that no one is talking about the contractors. The contractors, which there are hundreds of thousands of, are not going to get paid back. These people are very often not able to eat right now. So I don't understand why we aren't talking about them.
Yeah, Roger from Downingtown, Pennsylvania. My take is that if they would have addressed the problem from the get-go, nobody be boo-hoo-hooing right now. As far as the government workers, no sympathy. They got great jobs, they got great pensions, they got great benefits. I feel no pain for them.
My name is JD, and I'm calling from Petaluma, California. I think the federal shutdown is a sham. I think it is very irresponsible, and it is not showing respect for those who serve our nation, all in the name of irresponsible government and leadership trying to build a wall between two non-warring nations.
Hi, this is Alan Johnson from Gardner, Massachusetts. I believe the federal employees have every right to slow down or even stop work at this point. The government needs to get back to work.
And now we turn to Zimbabwe. The price of gas rose to $12 a gallon on Sunday, a 150% increase imposed by the federal government. That's $12 a gallon. The price hike has led to massive protests met by violent crackdowns from the government. According to Amnesty International, at least 8 people have been killed in the protests and more than 200 detained. This all comes 6 months after Emmerson Mnangagwa became president and promised that he would get Zimbabwe back on sure economic footing following the 40-year dictatorship of Robert Mugabe. Andrew Meldrum is the Africa editor of the Associated Press and lived for more than 20 years in Zimbabwe. He joins The Takeaway from Johannesburg, where he's monitoring the situation. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tanzina.
So we've seen reports of these protests. Can you give us a sense of what is the latest in Zimbabwe now? How has the government been responding?
Since Monday, there have been 3 days of a national stay away, a national strike, and it has been marked by violence. And the government has responded very strongly, in fact, sending the military out in Harare, the capital, and other cities. And in Harare, the military opened fire on protesters, and several people were killed.
Can you give us a sense of the historical context here? We are hearing that there are people staying home from work, that schools are closed. Basically, there's essentially a shutdown countrywide over this fuel hike.
That's right. It's over the fuel hike, but actually it's a wider dissatisfaction with Emmerson Mnangagwa's government. He had come to power. Many rejoiced when Robert Mugabe left power just over a year ago. And Mnangagwa won disputed elections in the middle of last year, in July, August of last year, on the campaigning that he was going to bring a better economy to Zimbabwe. And in fact, Zimbabwe's economy has gotten worse. Many Zimbabweans I have spoken to, they're not quite sure which is worse, the price of gasoline, which you pointed out is the highest in the world at $12, or the fact that they have to wait in line for several days before they can get any gasoline. And even today, there were people out in the streets protesting against the government, but there were also people waiting in long lines to get bread because they didn't have basic necessities.
How did Zimbabwe get to this point?
It's hard to remember, but back in the 1980s and 1990s, Zimbabwe was really one of the most prosperous countries in Africa, and Zimbabweans enjoyed a relatively good standard of living. In 2000, when Robert Mugabe was challenged by the opposition movement for Democratic Change Party, Zimbabwe's economic management really faltered. The kind of point where things started to get bad was when Mugabe had seizures of white-owned farms. Definitely, land redistribution was needed in the country, but the way it was done took down the commercial farming sector, which was one of the major pillars of the Zimbabwean economy. The government continued to spend on the army and the police, and it took Zimbabwe to a period of hyperinflation in 2008, where Zimbabwe's inflation rose to 500 billion percent, according to the International Monetary Fund.
Mnangagwa is also in Russia. What do we know about his trip there? And I think there's a lot of outrage that he's left the country during this very critical time.
He's left at a critical time, but he is carrying out a critical mission. He met with Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday, and he told Russian media that he was asking for a loan or loans to help tide over and improve the economic situation. He's also going to several other countries where he's going to be looking for loans or perhaps looking for oil that he hopes will be able to improve Zimbabwe's economic situation.
Andrew Meldrum is the Africa editor at the Associated Press. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tanzina.
Zimbabwe isn't the only country going through a fuel crisis. Thousands of miles away, long lines of cars are causing frustration and worry throughout Mexico as a fuel shortage continues into its third week. The cause? Recently elected President Andrés Manuel López Obrador closed 6 major pipelines in response to increasing fuel theft by organized crime groups. The fuel thieves, called huachicoleros, steal approximately $3 billion worth of fuel every year by illegally tapping into those pipelines. Joining me now is Patrick McDonnell. He's the LA Times bureau chief for Mexico City. Patrick, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tanzina.
So, Patrick, who are these huachicoleros and how exactly do they steal the fuel?
Well, it's a very complex process, and there are gangs of these thieves called huachicoleros that essentially follow the hundreds, even thousands of miles of pipelines that bring refined gasoline to major areas such as Mexico City. And over the years, they've been around for 20, 30 years. They've learned to tap into these pipelines, and last year, for instance, they had as many as 12,000 illegal perforations. They also hijack trucks, very, very sophisticated organized crime networks based often in small towns along these routes. Entire families are involved, entire towns. It's quite a bit of corruption involving Pemex officials, which is the national oil company, plus local mayors and police. So it's a very, very sophisticated network.
Now, we mentioned in the introduction that they're stealing about $3 billion worth of fuel every year. What is the impact of the of that theft, essentially, on the Mexican economy, on the prices of fuel for average everyday Mexicans.
I mean, this is exactly what the president, Andrés López Manuel Obrador, is going after. He's very upset about this. He's known as AMLO here, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. One of his main goals is to do away with corruption. He feels this is an outgrowth of corruption, and he feels that $3 billion could be used for these very many social programs that he's trying to institute, including scholarships, including pensions. He's outlined a whole New Deal type array of plans for Mexico, and he wants to use that $3 billion for that. That is basically what he said. That money should be used for the people and not for pipeline theft.
What about the black market? Does this theft or has this type of theft, fuel theft, forced Mexicans to go to the black market for their fuel?
This has been going on for about 2 weeks now, and I mean, there has long been, the reasons the huachicoleros thrive is that they have established a vast black market for gasoline, not so much in Mexico City, but in a number of provincial areas. Since these lines started, we've seen some black market sales in Mexico City, but not that much, and I think the government does not want to go down that direction. But the essential problem is a massive black market because of the huachicoleros business. They steal this gasoline and sell it pretty much openly in many areas of the country at a price, you know, much less than what the government sells it at Pemex gas stations.
Now, I'm going to take a wild guess here and assume that AMLO is not the only president that's had to deal with this in the past. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the former Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, and his role with fuel theft, essentially. And if you could tell us a little bit about the so-called gasolinazo, which he had to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, this has been an issue going back three or four presidents, including during the presidency of Enrique Peña Nieto, who left office last November 30th. And he also tried to militarize the situations, send out troops, send out police to the pipelines. There were many clashes during his administration between authorities and local huachicoleros who are armed and often in cahoots with drug traffickers. But he was not able to really make a dent in the problem, which grew substantially during his administration. And you mentioned the gasolinazo. That's something that happened 2 years ago in 2017. Peña Nieto was instituted an energy reform. They took some subsidies off gasoline. Prices went up substantially, and there was in early 2017 there was a lot of social unrest, including riots. To this point, and these shortages have been going on for several weeks now, I think most people in Mexico have been pretty patient, considering, you know, waiting 2-3 hours at times in lines, although the situation has improved in the last day or two in Mexico City. But we haven't seen the kind of social unrest one sometimes associates with gasoline shortages.
Patrick McDonald is the LA Times bureau chief for Mexico City. Patrick, thank you.
My pleasure.
Have you seen this?
Is this the best a man can get?
Over the weekend, razor company Gillette released a 1 minute and 48 second short film on social media,
making the same old excuses.
Boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys.
But something finally changed.
Allegations regarding sexual assault and sexual harassment.
In this era of Me Too, the ad confronts toxic masculinity with a message asking men to be better and accountable. The brand even took its 30-year-old tagline, "The Best a Man Can Get," and flipped it to promote the new campaign, "The Best Men Can Be."
We believe in the best in men.
Men need to hold other men accountable.
Smile, sweetie. Come on.
To say the right thing. To act the right way.
Bro, not cool. Not cool.
And we asked you about it, and your reactions were strong and mixed.
I love the new Gillette ad.
This ad goes way overboard by indicting all men.
I am a woman, and I think it's great.
It certainly hits me as a father.
Gillette said they expected debate, and boy, did they get it. But like all marketers, they also want that debate to generate sales. Our next guests understand exactly what it takes to sell a product. Josh Weltman was a co-producer for Mad Men and is the author of Seducing Strangers, How to Get People to Buy What You're Selling. Josh, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, nice to meet you, Tanzina.
First off, I used to cover this advertising industry. I miss Mad Men, so Josh, I think you've got work to do again. I used to catch it live Sundays, so miss it. But let's get back.
I miss it too.
I mean, really, it was fantastic. But let's talk about Gillette here. Gillette said they wanted debate. They got it. Was it the type of debate that they were looking for?
I would imagine, yeah, I think it's great. I think ads are about setting expectations for products and services. And I think that when products and services exceed expectations, you get happy customers. And I would imagine that Gillette executives getting a lot of people talking about their ads like we're doing right now has far exceeded their expectations for what would happen with the campaign. I bet they're very happy.
I want to ask you about where do you think Gillette stands, Josh, in the American psyche as a brand? Is it a utility brand? Is it a sexy brand? Is it a brand that we think about? Like, is it a men's brand? Like, where is it today?
You know, I think it's a legacy brand, and I think that it's one of those things that's been around so long and people know so well that it almost fades into the background. I think that's why they're doing what they're doing, and they're doing a good job. They're making it relevant again by changing the meaning of the tagline from judging a man by how he looks and what he has to how he behaves and what he does.
I want to sort of talk a little bit about the different kinds of goals that advertisers have. I mean, clearly advertisers want to sell products, right? Clearly, Gillette is hoping that somebody will buy a Gillette razor, not that they'll flush it down the toilet. We're seeing different reactions, obviously, but let's talk a little bit about there's paid media, right? Media that like we see advertisers taking advertising out in newspapers or paying for commercials. But then there's this thing called earned media, right? The sort of buzz or the halo effect that your product gets organically. What is more important to brands?
I think what's important to brands is not necessarily the type of media where the conversations take place, but what the conversation is. I think that consumers or customers, people need four questions answered before they buy a product. And successful ads tend to answer one of those questions. The questions are, what is it? Why do I need it now? What makes it different? And who else thinks it's good? What sort of group or social community does buying into this product or this service make me a part of? So I think that the Gillette ad is really a part of the last type of ads, which is talking about, you know, are you a new man or an old man? Type of thing.
You know, in the show in Mad Men, I recall Don Draper would talk a lot about emotion in advertising and about doing the right thing. And ultimately, I'm thinking about when he, towards the end of the series, took out this big anti-tobacco ad, which in those days would have been considered sacrilegious almost. But that idea that advertising is about emotion, this ad is very much about emotion. P&G with Procter & Gamble, the company that owns Gillette, is not new to this. I mean, a couple years ago, they did a huge campaign around mothers for the Olympics that was very emotional. What's the role here that emotions play?
I think people basically communicate for only two reasons, either to transfer facts or to evoke emotions. And the fact is, the product hasn't changed. Gillette is still about selling you a sharp little piece of steel. But the thing that's changed that they have to address is what it means to be a good man, to be the best man. And that's going to be a completely emotional story. Our connections as humans are based on emotions.
One of the things that we've been sort of talking about here, in addition to the We Believe ad, which feels like an ad and a public service announcement at the same time, how does that compare to more recent political ad campaigns like Nike, for example, that featured Colin Kaepernick, or the Levi's campaign that came out right around the midterm elections, encouraging Americans to get to the polls?
I think you see what people in advertising agencies call sort of manifesto ads. Usually when something has changed and the company has to address it, either you see car companies now doing it a lot. Because the idea of a car being judged strictly by sort of how big and fast it is versus how clean and green it is putting pressures on them to look relevant. So you see car companies running, this is who we are, this is what we believe. Or you'll see Colin Kaepernick or anytime there's controversy in the field and a company has to sort of come down on one side of the line or the other, typically they'll do one of these manifesto ads that says, this is who we are, this is what we stand for. You know, companies, in my opinion, exist as promises to the marketplace. And products and services are how they make good on that promise. And every now and then a company has to sort of get out there and say, remember, this is our promise.
Do consumers demand that a product be connected to the social good just generally, more so maybe than they have in the past, or is it less relevant?
I don't know if it's less or more relevant. I think that, you know, most of the time you're selling tools that can be used for either good or bad. I think there's probably more pressure on consumers to give other people or things responsibilities for how they behave and where they end up in the world.
I'm wondering, is it the brand's responsibility, if you will, to fill that gap? I mean, does this indicate that maybe there's a social gap that we need to fill here? Brands shouldn't be really inputting their opinions.
I think brands are just fancy words for reputations, you know, and I think every person, every brand, every company, if they're smart, should have a reputation, a good reputation for doing good things.
Josh Weltman, co-producer of Mad Men. Thanks for joining us, Josh.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Diane from East Hampton, New York. It's about time. Not sure I approve of all the scenes in the beginning showing how we women have been sexually harassed for decades, but in the end, tying it all up the way they did, it states a positive message. They probably could have had a few more scenes showing how to empower little girls along the way. Overall, I think it's a good thing that they're doing.
Hey, this is Terry Mintz from Bend, Oregon. I think it's really well done. It isn't pedantic or preachy, but the disconnect scene with the men mindlessly chanting in front of the barbecues that boys will be boys was very impactful to me. For me, the ultimate message was driven home in the last scene where we saw men standing up for the fair treatment of women in front of their young sons. This was my ultimate takeaway. Men, be your best selves for the sake of the next generation. Teach them well and by example so that they can grow up respecting women as equals.
My name's Chris from Middlesex Borough, New Jersey. I think the Gillette ad is very powerful, and it certainly hits me as a father of two boys, age 5 and 3. I think it's very important that as a father, I raise them to be the best they can be, and that they stand up and treat others well and fight against those incidents of sexism and patriarchy, and to behave well themselves, but also to challenge others to behave better.
Hi, my name is Andy. I'm from New York City, and I love the new Gillette ad. Clearly, this needs to be blatantly explained to men in this current climate with the current president. A message is being sent that anything goes and anything can be said, and that is untrue when living in a civilized society. I think more companies need to make more statements in their advertising.
This is Kim in Hawaii. I am a woman, and I think it's great. It reflects many of my male friends who are good and gives clear guidelines to those that are clueless how to break the pattern of harassment, condescension, and bullying. What shocked me was the numbers of thumbs up to thumbs down on the video. When I watched it, it was 104,000 up and 380,000 down. This is so disheartening and stirs my anger.
And thanks, everybody, for your time today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. We always want to hear from you. Tweet us at The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.